that evil lurks in the hearts of men. The Shadow knows.
The cackling laugh and the strains of Saint-Saëns on Farley's spinning wheel, introducing one of the most celebrated thriller series on American radio, The Shadow. He was as much a superhero as a detective, using his mysterious powers to fight crime in the seamy underworld of Depression-era America. In this, the last of our programs on the radio detectives, we'll hear recordings never broadcast in Britain before, and look under the Shadow's wide-brimmed hat to find one of the most famous actors of the century.
I am looking for a man with blood on his hands. The blood of a minister and 10 innocent people he murdered.
Are you a man hiding in the fog?
Do not try so hard to pierce the fog. You cannot see me, for I am the Shadow.
The character emerged from the richly creative relationship in the 1930s and 1940s between pulp fiction and radio. The pulps were mass-circulation thrillers of 50 to 60,000 words in length, churned out monthly by an army of overworked, underpaid hack writers, and decorated with eye-catchingly vivid, not to say lurid, covers, tempting the would-be readers to part with their cash for the chance of sampling the thrills and sensations contained within. Their nickname derived from the wood pulp from which their cheap paper was manufactured, but it also carried the onomatopoeic ring of a savage beating, which appropriately signified the world of crime fiction. The battle against crime was a staple of the pulps, reflecting widespread public concern at the level of organized crime in 1930s America. To combat it, it sometimes seemed that a man with supernatural powers was needed. The flavor of the stories can be gleaned from the first page of the first ever Shadow story, The Living Shadow.
The fog was thick at the center of the bridge, where the man stood leaning against the rail. Although the streets of New York were scarcely 100 yards away, he might have been in a little world of his own. For the only light in the midst of that cloud of black night fog came from an arc light on the bridge. A taxicab, carrying a late passenger home, shot through the mist. The man stepped away from the rail and crouched beside a post. He saw a flash of the red tail light on the cab. A moment later, it was lost in the fog. As the noise of the motor died away, the man stood up again and placed his hands on the rail. He listened, as though afraid that another cab might be coming across the bridge. Then, reassured, he leaned over the rail and stared downward. Mist. Thick, black mist. Nothing but mist. It seemed to invite his plunge. Yet he hesitated, as many wait when they're upon the brink of death, until, with a mad impulse, he swung his body across the rail and loosened his hands. Something clamped upon his shoulder. An iron grip held him balanced between life and death. Then, as though his body possessed no weight whatever, the man felt himself pulled around in a sweeping circle. He staggered as his feet struck the sidewalk of the bridge. He turned to confront the person who had interfered. He swung his fist angrily, but a hand caught his wrist and twisted it behind his back with irresistible power. It seemed as though the man's strength had been wrested from him as he faced a tall, black-coated figure that might have represented death itself. The stranger's face was entirely obscured by a broad-brimmed felt hat bent downwards over his features. The man who had attempted suicide was too startled to speak. He felt himself pulled across the sidewalk, and at the curb he stumbled through the open door of a large limousine, which he had not seen until that moment. The door closed, and the car moved on. A voice spoke through the darkness. It was a weird, chilling voice, scarcely more than a whisper, yet clear and penetrating.
"Your life is no longer your own. It belongs to me now."
The leading pulp publishers were Street and Smith, and they had a weekly radio mystery show in which their thriller stories were dramatized. The program was introduced and narrated by a mysterious figure with a sinister laugh, known only as The Shadow. This character became so popular with radio audiences that Street and Smith decided to feature him in his own magazine. And in April 1931, the first Shadow magazine appeared on the newsstands. It was written under the pseudonym of Maxwell Grant by Walter B. Gibson, a 33-year-old magician and crime writer who turned the disembodied voice with the chilling laugh into a mysterious crusader against evil, clad in black cape, slouch hat, and concealing scarf, sporting twin Colt 45 revolvers and acting through a network of agents and a series of multiple identities. The character was a potent mixture of Zorro, the Scarlet Pimpernel, the cloaked and masked French master criminal Fantomas, and Frank Packard's now-forgotten New York club man and crime fighter, Jimmy Dale. The Living Shadow was a sensational success, and the saga was launched. It ran in pulp magazine form from 1931 to 1949, eventually comprising 325 complete novels. Gibson wrote 282 of them, delivering two 60,000-word novels every month. He composed directly onto the typewriter, moving from one to another of three machines as the words poured out of him. Gibson explained his method of work.
I had gone on the theory that 2,000 to 3,000 words a day was a writer's proper stint, perhaps the maximum one is capable of, certainly a good day's work. But to meet the shadow schedule, I had to hit 5,000 words or more per day. I geared for that pace and found that instead of being worn out by 5,000 words, I was just reaching my peak. I made 10,000 words my goal and found I could reach it. Some stories I wrote in 4 days each, starting early Monday morning, finishing late Thursday night. On these occasions, I averaged 15,000 words a day. By living, thinking, even dreaming the story in one continued process, the ideas came faster and faster. Sometimes the typewriter keys would fly so fast that I wondered if my fingers would keep up with them. And at the finish of the story, I often had to take a few days off, as my fingertips were too sore to begin work on the next book.
The success of the novels led inevitably to the new version of The Shadow returning to radio in his own show. Gibson had nothing to do with the radio show, and indeed it developed differently from the novels. In the books, The Shadow was, in reality, Kent Allard, internationally famous aviator. But when he was not being The Shadow, he posed as Lamont Cranston, big game hunter and explorer who was frequently away on expeditions. For the radio series, The Shadow really was Lamont Cranston. In place of a network of agents, he acquired a glamorous female companion, Margot Lane, and also a powerful and unusual weapon in his fight against crime. He'd mastered in the Orient the technique of clouding men's minds so that they couldn't see him, only hear his voice, and he used this ability to terrorize evildoers. It was a perfect radio device. The first shadow in the new radio incarnation was Robert Hardy Andrews, but the most famous, even though he played it only for the 1937-38 season, was Orson Welles. In conversation with Peter Bogdanovich, he recalled his involvement in the series.
I was the original Lamont Cranston, as far as I know, but I wouldn't
want to... But you didn't write that.
Oh, no, my God, I didn't even know how they came out. Mm-hmm. I didn't rehearse them, you know, I didn't have dress rehearsals. I didn't know how I'd get out of the well ever when I was thrown in.
Yeah, and the laugh was your laugh.
Yes, and all the children in the world did it, you know, in those days.
Oh, I did
kid.
It.
Yeah.
Oh, that was my favorite radio show.
Yeah. People keep talking about it. I hear on television, people keep talking, making jokes about Lamont Cranston. They still remember that name.
They remember it. The Shadow.
And they don't know I was it. I keep wanting to say, that was me.
You hear, Margot? The temple bells of Niban. Listen. Three soft notes will strike, and then the spell will be broken.
How did Welles get the part of the Shadow? His biographer Simon Callow explains.
His first really big-scale venture in radio was a sort of so independent effort of his called Les Misérables, which he adapted himself extremely well, in my view, and played Jean Valjean. And the company that had commissioned this decided that if they were going to revitalize the Shadow, which had already existed with another performer, and adapt it so that there was a sort of dual personality, so that the Shadow became something rather like Superman, that he had a double identity, that maybe Welles would be the man for the job. It was supposed to be secret. Nobody was supposed to know that it was him. But Welles being Welles, the secret got out or was let out at the first possible opportunity.
Perhaps reflecting the Scarlet Pimpernel inspiration and the upper-class gentleman crime-fighter tradition, Welles opted to give Lamont Cranston a virtually English accent.
There's a sort of sense of a silk dressing gown and a cigarette in a long cigarette holder about the performance. He was quite Anglophile, But he also loved doing his English accent. I mean, it gave him great pleasure to do that, and he sort of did it at every possible opportunity. And Wells, who came from the Midwest, was one of the best-spoken actors on the American stage, in the sense of that almost all American actors who worked in the classics aspired towards a sort of English accent. And in this case, it's almost comic to think of Wells doing this rather clipped drawing room comedy sort of voice. It's very charming, I think, very charming indeed. And as I say, the drawing room comedy and the relationship with Agnes Moorehead, who was the actress that Wells admired more than any other actress in the world, it's very amusing, the byplay between them. It's delightful, really.
Well, here we are, Margot.
Yes, but where, Lamont? The fog's so thick I can't see a thing.
This is the little village where the Reverend Colby and 10 of his parishioners were killed by a mysterious explosion in his church.
Oh, that was horrible. But, Lamont, it happened days ago. What can we do?
Murder has been committed, Margot. Wholesale murder, and the killer or killers are still at large.
But according to the newspaper report...
Yes, I know. The paper said the authorities have been unable to uncover a possible motive. Investigation is hampered by the refusal of the fisher folk of this quaint little village to cooperate.
Perhaps they're afraid to talk, Lamont.
Yes, it's surprising what superstition can do.
What about this rich Mrs. Ackley you were talking about, Lamont? Where does she fit into the picture?
I don't know, Margot. All I know is that about 3 months ago, she returned from the Far East with a man who calls himself the Prophet. This man claims to be the leader of a cult worshipping a deity known as the Ancient One.
Is there such a cult?
There was, but it was stamped out nearly 5 centuries ago because its ceremonies and rituals included human sacrifice.
Human sacrifice?
Yes.
Oh, how horrible. Then you think there is a connection between the so-called Prophet, the destruction of this Christian church, and the murder of Reverend Colby?
Margot, I don't know. I'm going into that cottage down the road. There are some Christians.
I'll wait in the car. Oh, that awful foghorn. It gives me the creeps.
You'll be safe here, Margot, but don't get out of the car.
All right.
Now, Lamont Cranston and the Shadow are going to find out something more about this mystery of the house on the cliff.
When he becomes the Shadow, this famous Oriental trick of the disembodied voice, then he becomes very grave, and he sort of plunges into his double bass area. And as Lamont Cranston, he sort of plays rather more bassoons and flutes, and it's a very effective contrast.
So you weren't expecting me. And yet prisons are filled with shadows. Shadows in the minds of men walking in the shadow of death itself.
What do you want? You put me here, sent me to the chair. Why can't you let me alone?
Because your career of murder is not over. Because I know you mean to carry out the threat you made in court.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can't stop me, Shadow.
I can. Because you're going to tell me how the jury, the prosecuting attorney, and Judge Wilson are going to be killed.
You're crazy. I'm not telling you anything, Shadow. I'm not afraid of you anymore. I got nothing to lose.
You are telling me, Brecker.
Yeah?
You see, I can read your mind. One thought is racing through your mind now. It's mirrored in your eyes, etched on your brain.
You're lying, trying to trick me into telling you.
All right, I'll tell you what you're thinking about. You're thinking of a man. He acts strangely. He's... shell-shocked.
No.
Am I right?
No, no, stop it.
This man is very close to you. I've got it. He's your brother. His name is... let's see. Danny. Danny, isn't it?
No, no, go away. Leave me alone.
Thinking that even now your brother, Danny, is hurrying home to get a high-powered rifle. That's all I need to know, Brecker. All I need to know.
No.
What made Wells's Shadow so arresting and mysterious was his idiosyncratic delivery of the lines, introducing pauses at unpredictable moments.
He was very admired for his rhythmic irregularities. He later developed a much kind of smoother overall legato delivery. But as a young man, his phrasing took everybody by surprise. Part of it was because he generally hadn't read the scripts before, so he's kind of busking it a little bit. Sometimes he didn't know how a sentence was going to end when he started it. But nonetheless, he did very consciously and cleverly phrased in a constantly surprising way.
The Shadow radio shows were strongly influenced by the contemporary Hollywood cinema. They were, in effect, half-hour oral movies, employing techniques such as montage to create atmosphere and advance the plot.
Engine room.
Stand by for test number 11.
Engine room standing by, Commander.
Ship full speed ahead! What the... Engine room! Hello! Hello, engine room!
Chief Engineer Swain reporting. Boiler explosion, sir. 3 casualties, sir.
Good Lord, what happened, Commander?
Boiler explosion, Lieutenant. Hard luck, sir.
Luck nothing.
You mean another case of sabotage?
Yes, sabotage.
Submarine L-21 calling submarine base. Submarine L-21 calling submarine base.
Submarine base answering L-21. Go ahead, L-21.
Submarine L-21 in distress. Submarine L-21 down off Diamond Head. Cannot rise. Emergency. Emergency. Top damage. Looks like sabotage. Looks like sabotage.
Like the cliffhanging cinema serials, the shows gloried in trapping the Shadow in impossible situations and seeing him extricate himself. As, for instance, when he was trapped in a rapidly flooding burial vault in Society of the Living Dead.
So long, Shadow. Let's see you get out of that spot.
Shadow. Water. Water. There's water. Water. Shadow. The water's really steep on the floor already.
Yes, and it's rising every minute. I'm going to try to break down the door. Useless, Berger.
You mean you can't even save yourself?
No, I can't even save myself. Help doesn't come soon if this ball fills to the roof. The Shadow will die as quickly as you, Berger.
The Shadow not only used terror to obtain his ends, he also applied the deductive reasoning that was the stock in trade of the radio detective.
Let me see those notes, Margot.
What makes you think Hartnick Clay's is mixed up with this White Legion, Lamont?
Clay seemed rather confused when I appeared to him this afternoon as the Shadow. Now, let me clean up matters.
What have you got there?
It's a copy I made of a memorandum that was on Clay's desk.
Let's see. Oh, what in the world does it mean, these two words? Convocation, water chapel. Then this string of letters and numbers. SUNMAR2011. Doesn't make sense.
Yes, it does. S-U-N is Sunday. M-A-R is March.
Yes.
And then 20 and 11, Convocation Water Chapel, Sunday, March 20th at 11.
But that's today.
Yes, probably at 11 tonight. And I have an idea that the Water Chapel is the place where they're holding Alton Parker prisoner. We're going to find out. Bring the car and meet me in the block next to Clay's house at 8 o'clock, Margot.
Yes.
If Clay's is going to that meeting, we'll follow him.
The Shadow pitted himself against what was seen as the major threats to American society in the 1930s, a series of conspiracies, confirming what historian Richard Hofstadter saw as the paranoid strain in American politics. There were gangsters.
Before you pass sentence on me, I'm going to pass sentence on you. You, Judge Wilson, and Sloan, the prosecuting attorney. And those 12 good and true saps on a jury. And one more, maybe. The guy that really trapped me in the first place. The only guy smart enough to get me. The Shadow.
Order! Order in the court!
That will do, Joseph Brett. You have nothing to say in your own behalf.
This is in my own behalf, and you'd better listen, all of you. I know I'm on my way to the death house, to the chair. But I'm warning you. For every day I sit in the death house, one of you will be killed. Starting with the foreman of the jury. He'll die the day I burn.
Sinister secret societies like the White Legion, a Ku Klux Klan-type organization, also threatened American democracy.
The prisoner, William Devons, has confessed his part in a conspiracy against the sacred institution to the White Legion. We give him to the All-High Commander.
Let the accused know his fate.
Have you anything to say, Devons?
I plead with you, don't kill me.
I've got a wife and children.
Silence!
Please, let me go!
Give him another taste of the whip. That's better. Now secure the prisoner and stand him over the trap door.
Don't!
Open the trap!
Rings of foreign saboteurs threatening the defense systems of the nation were another recurrent element.
What are you waiting for, Shadow? Why don't you speak?
How long have you known I was in this room, Doctor?
For quite some minutes, Shadow. While I'm not a master of your art of invisibility, my mind is sensitive to such a forceful concentration as you exert to cloak your presence.
I see. Since you sent Rigo away, it is evident you are not afraid of me.
Fear is a luxury I do not allow myself, Shadow.
Your career of sabotage is over, Dr. Arnheim.
I think not. I have never met a man who did not have a price, Shadow.
I have only one price for your kind, Doctor. Prison.
Sometimes the stories contained a hard-hitting political message, as in the Shadow's powerful anti-war speech at the end of The Silent Avenger.
Well, I guess that's that. Don't suppose we'll ever know what really happened. Anyway, there's one consolation. Looks as if the Shadow fell down on this case just as badly as we did.
Not quite, Commissioner Weston.
Oh, so you got here in time to take credit for this, eh, Shadow?
There is no credit. No glory in the death of Danny Brecker, Commissioner Weston. He was a victim. A human instrument of destruction, fashioned by mankind, that teaches men to kill their enemies in time of war, yet expects them to forget their murderous art in time of peace. Danny Brecker was an enemy of society, a killer, but only because you and I and countless thousands made him one. No, Commissioner. There is no glory in this for you, or the Shadow, or for any man.
Simon Callow believes that the Shadow had a particular appeal for Wells.
In the context of Wells himself, they're very striking because they're all about guilt and conscience and how criminals would be caught out. And as Wells himself was so full of guilt about so many different things, and famously the radio happened to be on when he was making love to one of his girlfriends, and the Shadow's claim to know everything was sort of rather chilled him, and he quickly put his pants back on and went back home to his wife.
Wells gave up the role of the Shadow in 1938, and it was taken over by radio actor Bill Johnston, who played it until 1944, being succeeded in turn by John Archer, Steve Corkley and Brett Morrison, none of whom quite matched Wells in power or mystery. The series finally came off the air in 1954, 5 years after the Shadow magazine had ceased publication. It had become an integral part of the imaginative lives of the successive generations of young Americans growing up in the 1930s, 40s and 50s. We in Britain never heard the Shadow radio shows, but his adventures appeared from the late 1930s in the Thriller magazine, and British audiences were able to see the Shadow in films, for he had a low-budget movie career, beginning with a couple of features in 1937 and 1938, starring former silent screen idol Rod LaRock, a Columbia serial with Victor Jory made in 1940, and a trio of Monogram B pictures starring Kane Richmond in 1946. In the late 1940s, Wells himself contemplated a film version of The Shadow.
Wells did consider making a film of The Shadow amongst various other projects which seemed to somehow come from his past. He kind of reached this tremendous peak with Citizen Kane, obviously, and then almost as if he wanted to, Citizen Kane had been almost too serious for him, he then tried to spread himself back out again into all sorts of popular entertainments, magic shows, comedy shows on the radio, you know, he was sub for Jack Benny quite often, and he was always looking for whimsical, comical, melodramatic material. He'd really considered so many things, and The Shadow was just one of those many things that and I think he's right, it might well have made a rather marvellous film in his hands.
The Shadow finally returned to the big screen in 1994. The film was written by David Kep, who steeped himself in the radio shows and the pulp novels, and came up with an amalgam of the two, in which he explained how Cranston acquired his mysterious powers. He'd had an earlier career as a Chinese warlord and drug baron, and had plumbed the depths of evil before transforming himself into a crusader against crime. The film pitted Cranston against his alter ego, Shiwan Khan, a descendant of Genghis Khan, who arrives in New York dreaming of world conquest.
The Shadow knows.
The film was an exhilarating exercise in pure style, with some stunning Art Deco sets and an epic Jerry Goldsmith score. But it was compromised by the injection of the inevitable postmodern irony and by a hopelessly bland and uncharismatic performance from Alec Baldwin in the title role. For the real and inimitable experience of The Shadow, you have to go back to those original radio shows of the 1930s, when Orson Welles brought his formidable talents to the airwaves to create a living legend in the annals of crime-fighting.
The part of Lamont Cranston and The Shadow has been played by one of the most distinguished figures in the theatre today, Mr. Orson Welles. Mr. Welles, still a very young man, is making for himself a unique place in the field of dramatic art. We have been indeed fortunate in having Mr. Welles on our Shadow programs. But now I know all of you would like to hear a few words from Mr. Welles.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Words can hardly express my great enjoyment in doing this program for you. And now, before I leave you, I want to thank our sponsors for giving me the opportunity of doing this show. I want to thank our cast for the wonderful work they've done throughout our entire season. And above all, I want to thank you, our listeners, for your loyalty. We all hope you've enjoyed listening to the shows as much as we have playing them. And now, ladies and gentlemen, good night and goodbye.
You have just heard a dramatized version of one of the many copyrighted stories which appear in the Shadow magazine.
As you sow evil, so shall you reap evil. Crime does not pay. The Shadow knows.